Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, folks, it's now or never. And as a matter of fact, here's an interesting story. I know this isn't really news. Like, it's kind of news. I don't know when it was announced, but it was just recently announced that Hobby Lobby is going to close all their stores. And so this is an indictment on a lack of understanding of our government and a lack of understanding of our system and so forth. Now, I can understand Hobby Lobby closing the doors in California. I can understand Hobby Lobby closing their doors in New York and every blue state where they cannot get their protection. But the fact is, they're closing their doors because the IRS and because the government itself is trying to inflict, you know, punitive damages on any company that is not willing to do some of the things that the federal government is trying to mandate. So there's a really good story out there that identifies why the CEO and the founder, and I believe, what's this guy's name? David Green is the CEO and founder. Now, if you know David Green, and you want to save jobs, you want to save your, you know, if you've got people working at Hobby Lobby, then everybody needs to call and say, hey, you need to do what GR is telling you to do. Don't give up and don't close down. What we need, folks, are we need corporations just like this that are willing to take a stand and dig in, because there's no doubt he's in Wyoming. There's no doubt he's in Montana. There's no doubt. And so what he should do in the closing and the selling of those resources in those blue states, the capital and the money that he gets, he can easily entrench himself and build and actually fight through these, I'll just say, these constitutional states. In building constitutional states, we'll be able to actually force the federal government into compliance by using Republic Review and everything else. This all can dovetail. If this guy truly surrenders and truly basically takes his money and runs and has how can you be a Christian and turn your back on everybody that is under the sword, under the gun of government, being compelled to do all of these terrible things? And so let me kind of dive a little bit into this story, because he talks about these principles and so forth, and then he talks about some of the stuff that the government is mandating, and this mandate on healthcare, the mandate on abortion, and so forth. And he basically is saying that, you know, we're not going to do this, and we're not going to allow the government to compel us to, you know, pay $1.3 million a day in government fines. And so all he needs to do is go into states that will actually protect him. He needs to go and create barriers from these states to basically say, you can't do this. You can't punish our companies that do not want to follow, because we've already won. The courts have already come out and literally stated that the federal government cannot mandate vaccinations. They can't mandate this health care. They can't mandate specific functions of that healthcare, that every company and everybody has a conscientious right, or a right to conscientiously object to these repugnant policies. So it's good to see that somebody's claiming to be Christian. And, you know, I'd like to see him actually step in the right direction, because a Christian doesn't run. A Christian learns how to actually win and overcome, and especially when it comes to evil. And folks, we have the way of actually overcoming. You know, this is why we actually have petitions against companies and organizations like Walmart and others, like Amazon, that refuses to allow you to use their space to exercise your constitutional rights. There's no such thing as private property in America, other than your property. When it comes to a business, a public business, that's public property. If you can walk in to buy something, if it's open, if the doors are open to everybody, then they cannot deny you your constitutional rights. Now, if it's a club, if it's an ideological, you know, like a religion or something like that, that's different. That's completely different. That's a different type of organization. But people that step into the sphere of commerce, you know, you have to exercise the constitutional rights, or you have to protect the constitutional rights of others, because it states right there in the 14th Amendment that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. So anyway, it saddens me to see this, but David Green at the Hobby Lobby, you know, organization, the corporate headquarters, the CEO, he it saddens me to see that he's surrendering. Folks, if we have Christians without backbone like this, then we're basically being thrown to the wolves. And you know what? They will come after him. He doesn't understand. Anybody that stands up on principles and tries to run, that's all right. You're going into their little books, and if they win and they gain control, they will come after you. That's why we have to actually start doing what we're supposed to do and go after each and every one of them. We have to have our own book and say, here are all the culprits that are out there trying to destroy us, organizations that are trying to destroy us. So it's time we actually start recognizing it is now or never. Now, I hope you've garnered what we're talking about and the way our government actually can function like an immune system. It's dependent upon you and I to do this. We absolutely have to continually demand compliance on the Constitution. Full compliance is what we have to keep on pounding and demanding. So what we're going to cover today is we're going to get into the Assumption Acts and the Cod Fishery Acts. And I just wanted to take a little sidetrack on this Hobby Lobby problem. And as you know, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org as well as ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, because we already tell you that. And if you go to Reclaiming the Republic, you'll be able to find all of those articles that we've mentioned that helps you start recognizing the design of this system is truly that of an immune system with all these different checks and balances. Yeah, there are some things that the federal government has the power to do, but even with martial law, even with martial law, the federal government was never granted the ability. As a matter of fact, they were constrained. Right there in the ratification base, they could not declare martial law throughout the United States. They could only declare martial law to where the militia was deployed and to the, you know, to that area of where the militia is deployed. They could then suspend martial law and those types of things. But the parameters are, first, they have to deploy the militia, and then where they deploy the militia is where they can declare martial law. So if you're hearing somebody, if you're hearing somebody flap their gums that Lincoln declared martial law for the entire United States, he didn't have the authority, nor do they have the constitutional power and or role, responsibility, and power to do that. In other words, they can only declare martial law to where he was deploying the militia. And the real problem is, after a few months, they fired the militia and they established a standing army. So by establishing a standing army, that no longer falls under the federal militia. The federalized militia, or the utilization of state arms, they actually created under the Constitution, under this bogus guise of war. I mean, it's not like America was under attack. America wasn't under attack. And this is why Lincoln was such a nefarious man in doing everything he possibly could to protect his reputation. The last thing he wanted to do was fail as the president of the United States, that the whole, this beautiful experiment known as the United States was to be destroyed on his watch. And so he was hardened and prepared through his life of failures to basically take a stand, and he took the wrong stand initially, and then finally he started getting some things right, but he never got it completely right. And I'm telling you something, folks. right, wrong, or indifferent, you may not agree with me, but there was a reason why that man didn't live post-Civil War. Now, you can say that, you know, the pro-slavery, the anti-Lincoln, and so forth, you know, there was this big cabal, and there was, but the fact is that the divine hand of providence needed a healing process and wanted to make sure that healing process was able to actually come to be. The radical Republicans and what they did in the 14th Amendment, I don't believe Lincoln would have allowed some of that stuff to happen. He was a tyrant. He wasn't a man that conscribed for individual liberty and would have considered supporting individual liberty. And I think that America, he served America in the way he needed to, in the way the Lord prepared him to. And then I think what had to happen was the power had to get back into the hands of the representatives of the people. We weren't to have a monarch or a single president lead us in the recovery. And so even with Johnson himself was a, I'll just say it, I mean, the man was a scourge because he was actually trying to protect and defend the evil doings that the states were doing at the time. But this show is not about the 14th Amendment. We've digressed a little bit, but when we come back, what we want to do is we want to get into the Assumption Act, and then hopefully if we have time, we'll start off into the cod fishery bounties. So when we come back, we'll dive into the first after this.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I had to laugh going into that break. At least I caught myself and not went down the path of trying to describe before the break that the Assumption Act was the first overreach of Congress in going beyond the enumerated roles, responsibilities, and powers and property that was delegated to the federal government. And so there's a little history behind all of this. And what we want to do is I want to cover what this history is. And this compromise happened in 1790, right? What was 1790? Well, it was the year right after the new federal government formed. And I believe that this was actually, if I remember correctly, we'll have to look at the actual day. Yeah, May 30th, 1790. So this was the preparation and the onslaught of this violation started in the very first session, and it bridged into the second session of Congress for that first term of Congress, or the House of Representatives. And so what I'm going to do is I've kind of consolidated some basic information regarding this. And so let me just go ahead and read this encapsulation of this compromise on 1790. On June 20th, 1790, when Congress was temporarily meeting in New York City, the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, hosted a dinner, and in attendance were the Secretary of the Treasury, which was Alexander Hamilton, and Representative of Virginia, James Madison. Now, keep in mind, these men were on opposing ends of the political spectrum. Hamilton, a Federalist, wanted the federal government to hold the bulk of the political and economic power. Madison and Jefferson, Republicans. Now, see, he's referring to a party that hadn't actually begun yet. And actually, in 1790, this is actually Madison and Jefferson and he. So this was actually written. Let me back up. I captured this. So this is really a good encapsulation of what happened. And this is authored by a person that goes by Jay Kratz. And so I don't know who he is, but bottom line, this is kind of an encapsulation. But what I want to do is I want to go through this and help you understand where, you know, some things aren't perfect. And we can get it closer to perfect. Maybe we won't make it perfect, but here's the whole point, that both Madison and Hamilton, now Jefferson was not in the country. He was not really considered a Federalist. He was a revolutionary. He was the Declaration of Independence guy. He was the author of that. And so you can't say that he was necessarily a Federalist. And when he came in, he started combating with this, as I would told you, over the course of, you know, the beginning of this new Constitution, Federalists were being absorbed, or I should say the Anti-Federalists were morphing into and being absorbed by the Federalist Party. The Anti-Federalist Party really went away. The Anti-Federalist Party, which was basically a swamp party, became the Federalist Party. And so even though these men were diametrically opposed at that point in time, they weren't politically opposed per party, as this gentleman is stating. And so when we look at what Jefferson and Madison were doing, they were still basically under the umbrella of Federalists. But they started realizing that there was this real shift of the Federalists going away from what they sold during the constitutional ratification debates as a limited and defined government to this government that had implied powers and was much bigger than what was sold. And so anyway, moving on, nonetheless, the three men met to discuss a prolonged deadlock in Congress. And this meeting was a pivotal turning point in what was known as the Compromise of 1790. Back in January 1790, Hamilton had given his first report on public credit to Congress. On the most contentious issues in the report was Hamilton's recommendation that the federal government assume the state's substantial Revolutionary War debts. Hamilton believed this was necessary to establish the United States credit and promote investment. Furthermore, the debt rested in the hands of a number of small, wealthy citizens. Hamilton knew these men would take a keen interest in the success of a country that owed them money. The assumption issue had been debated in Congress for months. Northern members supported it because their debts were largely unpaid, but Southern members, including Madison, opposed it because the Southern states had paid off a significant portion of their debt. At the same time, and so you got to understand, that the growing fields and so forth, let's put this in context. After the Revolutionary War, and as we were trying to still rebuild this nation, because they didn't just have the federal government come in and bail them out and rebuild in a year or two. I mean, we were still licking our wounds, and it had been, you know, less than a decade since the Revolutionary War had ended. And so if you look at the factories and businesses of the North, where agriculture wasn't the main source or was shifting away from and going more towards mercantile and textile and manufacturing, that, you know, it took time to invest that kind of money in getting business and revenue going so that people could make money. We had trade debt problems and so forth. However, in the agrarian states, all they had to do was throw seed in the ground and voila. I mean, there was, you didn't have to build walls. You didn't have to repair or tear down buildings and rebuild them before you could become productive. You know, when you're using God's bounty and you're using the you know, if you're into husbandry, where you're raising, you know, whether it be sheep, cattle, or whether you're planting crops, it didn't matter. If you had the basic foundation of the seeds and or the livestock, you were in business. You were running in business, and business could quickly recover quickly, which is why the southern states, which were far more vested in the agrarian society, they were agriculturally based. This is why. And so one of the things he doesn't mention is that Jefferson and Hamilton actually argued as Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury back and forth over what the best direction for America would be. Jefferson said we needed to maintain an agrarian society, and Hamilton disagreed and said we need to move towards manufacturing and needed to basically, you know, start taking on the Industrial Revolution. Well, anyway, again, the assumption issue had been debated in Congress for months, and at the same time, Congress had been in a standstill over the location of the permanent capital. Although the Constitution mandated a seat of the federal government, it had not specified an exact location. Congress, over the course of the first year, had considered more than a dozen potential locations. The Funding Act, as introduced in the Senate in June 1790, records of the U.S. Senate basically stated, you know, that these things were being debated. The Funding Act of 1790, the bill version, records of the U.S. Senate and the National Archives, when Senator Pierce Butler of the South Carolina Senate, he presented a new residence bill on May 31st, 1790, he left the location blank. The deadlock continued into June when the Senate failed to pass a motion to fill the spot with the easterly bank of the Potomac. Subsequent motions designated Baltimore, Maryland, Wilmington, Delaware, which also failed. Hence the dinner meeting. Again, this is a dinner meeting between Jefferson, Hamilton, and Madison. Key was a bargain in which Madison agreed not to block assumption of state debt and convince enough Southern members to support it. In exchange, Congress would first pass legislation locating the capital on the Potomac after a 10-year temporary move to Philadelphia. So in other words, it was basically going to give this new District of Columbia that was going to be located on the Potomac, well, if that 10 years was going to give them the chance to build both Congress or the Capitol for the House of Legislation, both houses, they were going to create a building for the Supreme Court, and they were going to build a White House where the executive would operate the nation. And so they were going to have some other needful buildings, such as a Library of Congress, such as the General Accounting Office and buildings and so forth, because they needed to be able to have the, you know, they needed to have paper. They didn't have staples back then, but they needed to have the necessary administrative tools and equipment and properties for government to function. And so they went into Philadelphia, and this may be the earliest examples of a legislative log rolling or voting trading in Congress. Although there was no dispute that this meeting even took place, historians have been skeptical to what extent it had on the eventual compromise. Nevertheless, Congress passed this act in July and established the permanent capital that would become Washington, D.C. the very next month. And so when we start looking at the Funding Act and the assumption of the debt, that's exactly what happened. So in other words, this huge logjam was basically a compromise. And I've told you, compromises are bad. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so here's the key thing that you really want to see. You really want to read this. And so that was kind of an overview of how this was playing out. But what really ended up happening is, and this you'll actually find in the New York Daily Gazette, because remember, Congress, this very first session of Congress, or I should say the first 2 years of Congress, that was in New York. And so when we look at this article that was written, and this actually came out in the Daily Gazette, and I believe you'll find this also in the Libraries of Congress, as a part of the annals of Congress, because this is what Madison stated in congressional debate. And it's a nice, long diatribe. I could sit here and read all 9 pages to you, but I'm not going to. But what you really need to read and what your takeaway will be, in April of 1790, before this compromise occurred, Madison unequivocally stated that this was something that was unacceptable. This was not within the boundaries of the Constitution, and we shouldn't even be considering this. There were so many people that Madison impressed up to this point in time that Congress was not even going to consider the Assumption Act. And so Jefferson and Hamilton, so this is the backstory. And if you read Dumas Malone's bibliography, or I should say, you know, his six-book history on Jefferson, you'll start to see that Jefferson did have this proclivity and this weakness of, I'll just say, affluence. He grew up in one of the, you know, a very, I mean, Monticello, and the properties of Monticello were, you know, pretty substantial. His father may not have been much as far as in a public eye or what have you. If I remember correctly, he was a surveyor, but he was paid handsomely for his work, as well as, you know, the money he was making as a plantation owner. And if I remember correctly, I believe they were a part of the Randolph family as well. And so, anywho, let me keep going here so that you can kind of look at Jefferson looking for the opportunity of speculation. One of the things that Jefferson, and this is something I had heard via Dr. John R. Vile, that Jefferson's intent was to be able to go into the Potomac area. Now, tell me if this doesn't sound like Congress today, you know, where they go and they'll invest in companies that are going to win bids or contracts, or they would disinvest prior to them losing contracts or prior to their, you know, demise. Somehow they, you know, Congress has literally, they have these inside trader, you know, visions. They can play that game. Well, actually, they should never be able to play that game. They shouldn't be able to be investing in the markets that they can influence, period. I mean, if that came down, it's just like, what happened? Look at what happened to Pete Rose regarding being able to go into the Hall of Fame. He'll never be able to go into the Hall of Fame because he was caught placing bets and benefiting off of bets and gambling. Well, why is it that we allow our legislators or our congresspeople to do this? They need to have a standard, and we need to have a law, but they're never going to pass those types of laws. So anyway, back to Jefferson. Jefferson was one of the first, and he actually speculated, and he went out and he leveraged part of his, you know, holdings. See, the problem was Washington, D.C. was not going to explode and grow overnight. But he felt that the value of the land would increase more and more. And so he leveraged himself in buying property in the District of Columbia. He did this a lot. He spent a lot of money for books and doing things to where he was constantly either mortgaging off a little bit more of his farm, more of his property, his home, what have you. And so this is why the day he died, they foreclosed on all of Monticello, and the state of Virginia had to come in and buy that stuff back, because historically they thought it would be paramount that everything of Jefferson's be preserved. So technically, Jefferson, for post-Revolutionary War, the majority of Jefferson's life was funded by financiers and through, you know, subsidies and so forth by his mortgaging out all of his assets and resources. Nevertheless, he was a good friend and a great influence on James Madison. And he basically convinced James Madison to change his position. Now, I am telling you that James Madison had made mistakes. This itself was a huge mistake. And I believe that he's either rolling around in his grave, or there came a point in time when he had to face this and go, oh my, you know, this is kind of too much to bear. So bottom line, when we look at the Assumption Act, the arguments are really right in here, and you need to read this, because when we look at the ability for the federal government to assume state and subsidizing state property, first off, when they argued the uniformity clause, the federal government couldn't give advantages to one state or another. So when they started creating advantages by assuming all of the debt, that was not uniform because, again, southern states are either paid it off or they were close to paying it off, and that meant more money was being shifted and given an advantage to the northern states. And so this right here basically had the federal government put the union on its side somewhat in creating advantages for some when they didn't have the power to do that. The uniformity clause basically requires that the federal government not provide advantages or disadvantages, that all states would be treated equally. Well, assuming more debt, taking away the debt, a large sum of debt, is a huge, you know, lift of a burden from a state like Massachusetts. So the point is, as we start, you know, peeling back this Assumption Act and looking at what happened and how it happened, it helps you understand how the concept of implied powers started actually becoming a weapon against the Constitution. Now, as the framers debated the Constitution during the ratification debates, some of these things were pointed out by the Federalists. And the point of the matter is that when you look at what they were doing and how they were assuming the Assumption Act, it's not like they actually said, hey, this is in pursuant to this particular clause or this particular power. What they were doing was they were violating the Constitution. And that goes back to, you know, the Federalists basically saying, the Constitution doesn't allow those things. So which is it? Well, had they stuck to those definitions, the problem here is this, folks. If you've ever created a contract, unless you're really, really, really legally minded and you go through all the stipulations and everything else, you're going to want to protect your contract. You're going to want to protect your investments and so forth. But when they created this federal government, it was really, I don't think these men appreciated this. This is where I keep on going back to the fact that I think the divine hand of providence created something greater than what these men realized. And so they didn't understand how important it was to stay within those terms and definitions and boundaries with the greatest fidelity. That when they were entering into this union, when they were basically accepting, legally accepting the terms of this Constitution based on how it was defined, they failed you and I in allowing it to slide because they said, you know what, well maybe we can do some things like this. Washington warned us about this sliding, whether it be a noble slide for a good cause or not. He warned us that we should not be allowing our government to actually assume powers it should not have, that are not enumerated, that we need to follow the mode of modification. The mode of modification is by amending the Constitution to delegate those powers. And that's why this is all so important. So this migrates us into the next big argument that the federal government was facing, which was, again, an advantage for the northern states. Now, you can't be surprised when all of a sudden you start really, you know, diving into this thing called the bounty payments for cod fisheries. And this was January 6, 1792. So about 2 years later, the big government anti-federalists who became federalists now all of a sudden started pursuing this idea of getting the federal treasury, the federal government, to give them money to help keep a viable fishery, or I should say a fishing economy and or market space. And so there was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Livermore who actually, you know, started talking about, you know, this. In this debate, he started talking about the favors and the advantages that would come forth out of this cod fishery bounty bill, that if we granted the federal government to do these things, the great things that would happen. And Madison came back, and boy, he sure used shock value, and we are going to read specifically what he said in these debates. These are debates in Congress and Madison functioning in his official capacity. We'll be right back after this.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what I really want to do is I want to read the full text of this, because you're going to see the heavy hand in government already in 1792. Now listen, this is Mr. Livermore stating this. The bill now under consideration has two important objects in view. The one is to give encouragement to our fishermen, and by that encouragement to increase their numbers. So in other words, by creating this bounty, it will bring more people to buying boats and operating boats and getting out into the ocean and fishing for cod and fishing for, you know, fish, and bringing that fish back in to create revenue and so forth. Now, the other, remember he said that there are two important objects in view here. The other is to govern those fishermen by certain laws by which they will be kept under due restraint. Both these objects are of great importance to such persons to choose to employ their capitals in the fishery business, and I believe it will not be disputed that the business itself is of considerable importance to the United States, insomuch as it affords a certain proportion of remittance or exportation to foreign countries, and does not impoverish the country, but enriches it by the addition of so much wealth drawn from the sea. Now, I could go on and on of what he has to say, but right there says a lot. Because where in the Constitution is the enumerated power for the federal government to be able to regulate fishing or the market space of fishing? And so they don't, and it's not enumerated. And he goes on and on and on. And then Mr. Lawrence steps in and says, from examining the section, he conceived it contemplated no more than what the merchant is entitled to by existing laws. The merchant is now entitled to the drawback, but it is found by experience that the effect has not been to produce that encouragement to the fishermen, which was expected. And he presumed the way was perfectly clear to give a new direction to the drawback. And this is all aimed at in the bill. He supposed that the clause had no necessary connection with the question, which he'd been respecting the right of government to grant bounties. But since the question has been brought forward, it may be proper to consider it. In discussing the question, he inquired, what has Congress already done? Have we not laid extra duties? So, in other words, instead of saying, let's turn to the Constitution, he's going, well, what have we already done? How have we slid this boat in this direction, or this car, this vessel? How we've drifted as a government to assuming new roles and responsibilities? And so he goes on and talks a little bit more about it. But then the person that stands up and steps up and probably creates all sorts of gasps and sucks the air out of Congress is James Madison. And so Mr. Madison then, and I don't have enough time to finish this, so where we leave off, we'll pick up tomorrow on Election Day, okay? So this is what Mr. Madison says. In the conflict I feel between my disposition on one hand to afford every constitutional encouragement to the fisheries and my dislike on the other of the consequences apprehended from such clauses in the bill, I should have forborne to enter into this discussion if I had not found that over and above such arguments as appear to the natural and pertinent to the subject, others have been introduced, which are, in my judgment, contrary to the true meaning and even strike at the characteristic principles of the Constitution. Let me premise, however, to the remarks that I shall briefly offer on the doctrine maintained by these gentlemen, that I make a material distinction in the present case between an allowance as a mere commutation and modification of a drawback and an allowance in the nature of a real positive bounty. I make a distinction also as a subject of fair consideration, at least, between a bounty granted under the particular terms in the Constitution, a power to regulate trade, and one granted under the indefinite terms that have been cited as the authority on this occasion. I think, however, that the term bounty in every point of view improper as it is applied here, not only because it may be offensive to some, and in the opinion of others, carries a dangerous implication, but also because it does not express the true intention of the bill as avowed and advocated by its patrons themselves. For if in the allowance nothing more is proposed than a mere reimbursement of a sum advanced, it is only paying a debt. And when we pay a debt, we ought not to claim the merit of granting a bounty. It is supposed by some gentlemen that Congress have authority not only to grant bounties in the sense here used merely as the commutation for drawbacks, but even to grant them under the power by virtue of which they may do anything which they think conducive to the general welfare. He's using quotes here. This, sir, in my mind, raises the important and fundamental question whether the general terms which have been cited are to be considered as a sort of caption or general description of the specified powers, and as having no further meaning and giving no further power than what is found in that specification as an abstract and indefinite delegation of power extending to all cases whatever, to all such at least as it will admit the application of money, which is given as latitude as government could well desire. So let me stop right here. When we start looking at the problems that we're facing as a nation, the federal government truly believes that they can just apply any money that they want. But Madison has basically come right out and said, hold on. We've only been granted very specific powers, and that's what that money is for. So this is what Madison goes on and says. I, sir, have always conceived. I believe those who proposed the Constitution conceived. It is still more fully known and more material to observe. Those who ratified the Constitution conceived that this is not an indefinite government, deriving its powers from the general terms prefixed to the specified powers, but a limited government tied down to the specified powers which explain and define the general terms. So, in other words, that preface that I told you about when we went through the Constitution, that basically provided an overview of why or what these following powers are for the general defense and welfare of the Union. They do not granting powers in that general defense and welfare. They're basically stating that this is how we will promote the general defense and welfare. He goes on and says, the gentlemen who contend for a contrary doctrine are surely not aware of the consequences which flow from it and which they must either admit or give up their doctrine. So either they understand and admit that there are these consequences that they're going to put into motion, or they need to give up their doctrine and say, look, you know, we don't want to go down this path of that's going to completely subvert and pervert this Constitution and this Constitutional Republic. And so Madison goes on and says, it will follow in the first place that if the terms be taken in the broad sense they maintain, the particular powers afterwards are so carefully and distinctly enumerated would be without meaning and must go for nothing. Now see, what he's talking about is he's talking about the enumerated powers of Section 8 of Article 1. Remember, I told you there was this preamble in Section 8 that kind of gave you this, like I just said, a picture of these foregoing powers, that these following enumerations are the powers delegated. And they're delegated for this general defense and welfare of the United States. So, as he goes in, and I've got basically a minute left. So, because we're going to be getting into the post-election, actually tomorrow's not election day, tomorrow is where we're going to be having some real results nationwide and so forth. We'll probably talk briefly over that in our next episode, but what's really more important is they get back into this. So we're going to pick back up to where we left off right here, because this is where Madison goes back And I'm telling you, folks, he brutally tongue-lashes Congress for going down this path of trying to misinterpret and take a misconstruction of the General Defense and Welfare Clauses. And he actually uses shock value as he goes on down this path, because everybody in that room thought it would be good to use government for certain things. But they were aghast when he started mentioning, if we're going to use, you know, the purse to be able to spend money on whatever we want to spend money on, then why don't we take over churches? And so when we really start looking at the shock value he's going to deliver here. So before I bleed into the end here, folks, I want you to understand the cod fishery bounties is Madison taking Congress around the woodshed. And we'll prove that next week in our next episode. And oh, by the way, tomorrow is post-election, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.